This is the Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil reflect on the Supreme Court's decision to keep Trump on the ballot, break down the results from Super Tuesday, ponder whether Americans are suffering from collective amnesia about Donald Trump, and close with a look at some new research suggesting that Americans reward candidates who take hawkish foreign policy positions, even when those positions are in direct conflict with voters' preferences. Now, let's go to the lab.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Bill Muck, and I'm a professor of political science at North Central College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Phil Barker, who's a professor of political science at Keene State College. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm excited. I can't. It was State of the Union tomorrow. Like, my whole world is organized around this State of the Union. not really, but
it's telling that tomorrow is the State of the Union, and I'm a political scientist. And when we were talking before we started recording, you said something about the State of the Union, and I was unaware that it was happening.
I will tune in for two reasons. One, I think we need to see how Biden and the team confront this. He's old, right? So this is a chance for him not to look old. This will be a good metric to see how he looks and his perception and all of that. And two, to see how he talks about Israel. Is he critical of Israel? Does he suggest some separation? But other than that, I don't know what they're, you know, it's not a really exciting speech anymore.
I mean, it isn't. And I think that's the thing. Nobody really pays attention to it anymore. And the people are into sound bites and all of that. But I mean, this becomes the sort of beginning of the, we'll talk about Super Tuesday, but this in some ways becomes the beginning of the campaign. Like, he's laying out his argument about Trump as well. But so how are you, if you're Biden's advisor, how are you advising him in terms of looking young? Like, just wear like a tank top and a cool hat or something?
Yes, he does look good in hats. Hats make him look younger. So that may be, it may not be super presidential, but it would help with the age critique. I wonder, you know, oftentimes these speeches go long.
Yeah.
I would be inclined to do a shorter one, you know, do one that's 40 minutes, 45 minutes, look sharp, you know, high energy. I mean, I think it really, they've been trying to put Biden in places where he can look younger and dynamic and funny. And so, you know, I maybe a shorter speech, do something like that. Maybe a tank top, that would be as well. I mean, that's, think outside the box.
Well, you know, we talked about the tan suit, whenever that was, last week before, and you know, this is just a new way to set up new norms. Like, the State of the Union people yell at things at the president now. So you know, why not just embrace it? Go with the tank top, juggle a little, do whatever you need to.
This is absolutely right. So, but the more important, exciting news is that we're creeping up on our spring breaks, and so next week we are going to be traveling. Phil, what are we doing next week?
Yeah, well, you and I are going to going to Florida. What everybody wants to do. No, we're gonna go. We're gonna take a couple of days and go down. And this is technically a Politics Lab corporate retreat, I think, that we're doing. But we're gonna go catch some spring training baseball games, which I'm excited about. It's going to be nice just to have a little build time.
Absolutely. A little long weekend, sitting and watching some baseball and getting out of the cold weather for a little while. So it'll be good. Exciting.
And
yes,
also
absolutely.
Because of that, there's like a, I don't know, 15% chance that this is our last episode because one of us will get eaten by an alligator.
if an alligator comes after us, we're not going to be able to get away very quickly. We're just not young, spry men anymore.
So no, one of us.
This is a concern.
One of us would fall down, and the other would survive. Like probably would both fall down, but whichever of us falls second is going to get out of there.
Right. Whoever falls further away from the alligator, that's the issue. So. No, it'll be great. And we're hoping to record an episode before we go. But if for some reason there isn't an episode up next week, you know that we're at a baseball game and thinking of all our listeners. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, all right, before we dive in, you want to remind everybody how they can stay connected with us.
Yeah. So thepoliticslab.com is the webpage. And, you know, per usual, you can go there and click on this week's episode. And the reading load's a little lighter this week, but I think there's three or four articles. There's a really interesting article on the Trump SCOTUS decision, and we're going to talk, the last topic we're going to talk about, this kind of research on foreign policy imagery. Yeah. That article's there if you're interested in that as well. So articles to dig a little deeper on our topics if you want, all of that at thepoliticslab.com.
All right, well, let's dive in.
All right. So Last week was a good week for Donald Trump before the Supreme Court. On Wednesday, while we were recording, if you listened to last week's episode, it was announced that the Supreme Court would take up the question of Trump's immunity from prosecution in the federal case regarding January 6th, despite the fact that the lower court ruling was seen by most legal scholars as excellent, clear, and definitive. But then on Monday, the court handed down its decision in the case challenging Colorado's decision to remove Trump from the ballot via Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which bars from office any government officer who engages in insurrection against the government. The court's decision was unanimous, and the unanimous ruling was that Colorado could not single-handedly remove Trump from the ballot. And that wasn't particularly unexpected, but the logic that the court used was odd. So five of the justices issued an unsigned opinion stating that Congress must act to enforce the 14th Amendment, that they either have to pass legislation to add teeth to it, or it basically gives the power to Congress to do this. Legal scholars have pointed out that there is no indication that the amendment was meant to operate in this way, and it makes it virtually impossible to remove a candidate from the ballot in today's partisan environment. In addition, the ruling arguably goes beyond the question put before the court, and it results in essentially the long-dreaded, conservative-dreaded legislating from the bench. while liberal justices dissented to this logic, they also came down against Colorado. So in a really interesting piece, I thought it was really interesting, in The Atlantic, George Conway points out all the ways that this decision was puzzling, and ultimately he concludes that the court was ruling not based on the law, but instead based on fear of removing Trump from the ballot in an election year. So, Bill, I found Conway's argument compelling, and I tend to agree with him, but it raises questions of, you know, exactly what role the court mm-hmm. should play in a situation like this. We can talk a little bit about their logic. We can talk about the implications. So, you know, let's dig in. Do you want to start with the ruling itself? Where do you want to start?
Yeah, let's start with kind of, like you said, the logic of the ruling. And there's a couple interesting things about this. One, you're right, it was a 9-0 decision, but in some ways that masks a bit of division there, right? So you had the five men embrace this more aggressive interpretation of the amendment, saying that this has to go to Congress and that the courts don't have any role in this. This is an exclusively the role of Congress to determine, you know, the Article 14th Section 3 of that. So, and then the women were female justices were pushing back against that. So I think that's interesting when you have the men versus the women in this dynamic. But yeah, the logic itself is really, I will say, I've been very frustrated by this, Phil. It's sort of really upsetting because, you know, you and I, we're political scientists, and the field of political science gets that the Supreme Court is a political institution, and that these justices are products of a political system, and that we should expect there to be some political dynamics to their decisions. But this feels like you can't even pretend that it's not being driven by politics, especially mm-hmm. the four conservative men in their opinion, because I keep coming back to this argument that they make that this is not a right that states should have. States shouldn't have the right to disqualify a presidential candidate. On some level, I understand that. It makes sense, right? It could cause some chaos. And that's the word that they used, that it could create chaos in the system, that states are going to have these very different systems for interpreting it. And, you know, Democratic states are going to outlaw Republicans and vice versa. And it's going to be chaos, Phil. We can't have this sort of chaos. And so that's not a legal argument. That's a sort of a political argument to say we're worried about what might come. We think it's wise to not do this. But you and I spent a lot of time thinking about originalism, and these same justices premise their entire philosophy on the idea that you have to go back and look at the original intent. Original meaning? How did they understand this amendment? And it's pretty clear if you're going to apply originalism to this, Donald Trump should be kicked off the ballot and states should have the right to do that. So I've been so frustrated sort of thinking through this process and how you have, you know, justices who are very willing to cause chaos when it comes to voting rights and say states can have that power, very, very comfortable causing chaos with the Second Amendment, saying you can't have any sort of federal legislation, very comfortable with the chaos of the Dobbs decision and abortion, that, you know, you can give states all sorts of rights and create all sorts of chaos at a federal level, but you can't kick a candidate off the, you know, off the ballot. And I tend to think that's probably the decision they got to is probably the right one, but it's so inconsistent with the logic that they put forward that I've been grumpy about this, Phil, because it feels like they're being so openly political. Talk me down. I'm being too grumpy, right?
No, you're not. I think you're exactly right. Like, I tend to agree with you. I've been frustrated by this as well. And that's because I want the, you know, whatever the decision is, I want it to make logical sense, right? Like, I want to be able to sort of connect the dots. And like you said, I can't make that happen here. And that's the, you know, this idea of like, this would cause chaos and that would be bad is like you said, inconsistent with how this court has ruled on so many other things. Yeah. In fact, in the Conway article, I think it was the Conway article, he talks about, you know, I don't remember if it was Thomas or Alito who talked specifically about how that's not what the court should be concerned with. Like, they're not concerned with what the impact of their decision is. They're just supposed to interpret the law. And so this is just so inconsistent with how they have approached so many other things. And then I also turn to like this, even beyond that, beyond the inconsistency in how they approach this, this idea that allowing a state to make this decision would cause chaos also goes against the reality of how we've done elections for over 200 years, which is like, it is true that it is a little weird to allow every different state to make up their own rules. And you might say that would be chaotic, but I hate to break it to you. That's how we do it. Like, the Constitution lets every state decide this stuff. And I think when you look around the world, it's kind of bizarre. The idea that a federal election should be run by the federal government makes sense. But it's not the reality. So the fact is, like, there are candidates who, you know, Robert Kennedy and whoever else are on some state ballots and not on others. And we don't talk about that as being chaos or unfair or whatever. We say that's the state's, you know, a state is entitled to set whatever standards they have for getting on the ballot there. And so it doesn't line up politically. It doesn't the dots don't connect politically. The dots don't connect in terms of the sort of legal consistency here. I'm with you. And this idea, the other part is, it certainly doesn't connect with like the originalism argument. There's no other part of the 14th Amendment that Congress has to enact. And in fact, the whole idea of a constitutional amendment is that this is above Congress, right? This is a law. Like, Congress doesn't have to act to make parts of the Constitution work, right? I mean, it's just not the way it works. So, you know, we talked about when oral arguments happened in this case, it felt like the judges knew what they wanted to decide. They didn't want Colorado to do this, but they couldn't figure out how to get there. And I think they never could figure out how to get there, because the fact of the matter is, like, there, you know, there's some truth to, Alito's argument, if it was him, the argument that like the court should be ruling based on the law, not based on like the implications of, you know, that's, it should be this, you know, in theory, like, how do we interpret this law? And so, I am similarly frustrated, especially when like the whole point is the court is isolated and like insulated from politics so that they can make the difficult and controversial decisions when it's called upon. And so especially to see like what we've seen lately, which is a lot of judges doing the difficult, hard thing, whether those are the appeals court judges on the immunity case, whether it's some of the criminal judges or the civil and the fraud cases, where you have like these political players who have far fewer sort of institutional advantages, still doing the hard thing when it comes to Trump. And then to get to the Supreme Court, where they have really more than anybody else, the ability to actually make a difference and the political insulation and power to do it, and to see them do like afraid to do it. It's frustrating. I'm 100% with you.
Well, and I love how you point out that states have different rules for voting, right? So at federal elections, right? So, you know, how many early days can you vote? Can you mail vote? Every state has different rules. Some states are much more restrictive, right? So, and we've seen a wave of laws making it more difficult to vote, especially in Republican states, that make it in particular targeting voters of color, right? And making, you know, intentionally targeting those groups to say that we're going to make it a little bit more difficult. And the court has been consistent to say, well, that's a right of states. Right. You know, they're even pulling back the voting rights rights act to say, like, we this is not really a job for the courts to impose. States have the right to do this. Gerrymandering, which might arguably be the most pernicious thing in the U.S. political system to date, the court has said it's not really the job of the court to come in and tell states how to handle their elections. And if they want to gerrymander, that's entirely their right. And yet now it's not it is the court's responsibility to come in and say you don't have the right to toss a candidate off if they've engaged insurrection. Right? It's just it's so inconsistent in its logic, and that just really it's frustrating to listen to.
Well, and it seems inconsistent. Like when you read the wording of the 14th Amendment does give Congress power, but it gives Congress the power to remove this disability. So if anything, it should have been the opposite. Yes. The opposite. The actual interpretation should have been Colorado has the right to do this. And if Congress doesn't like that, Congress can intervene and remove that.
We should explain that for the listeners, right? So that in the actual amendment itself, it doesn't say whether states or who has the right to do this, but that Congress by a two-thirds majority can remove that. So if Colorado, like you said, were to ban Trump and the court were to say that's okay, the Congress could intervene and say, no, they have the right to be on the ballot, right? And that, I think that's such an important point you're making, because if for the court to say it's not self-executing, boy, that sure feels like it's self-executing. If you're creating a mechanism to put somebody back on the ballot, the clear intent is that they should have the right to do this already. I'm sorry I interrupted, but I think that's an important distinction there.
Yeah, so I think that's they're worried about state overreach or whatever. But that's the thing: the check is already in the system. Like the way it was envisioned by the people who wrote this amendment is one in which worried about this being abused, Congress has the ability to prevent that from happening. But instead, they've totally inverted it and said a state can't do anything unless Congress. Yeah, no matter how I come at it, I just can't make the yes. dots connect in a way that I want them to. That's where I come back to the Conway argument that they're afraid of Trump. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I'm torn on this a little bit, because I think I get the decision, right? I understand why they're doing it. But the reason why they're doing it feels particularly political, right? They don't like the outcome. And so then they're going to say, well, the Constitution isn't clear on this, right? And they are, especially the originalists, they say, whether it's Alito or Gorsuch, over and over and over again, they say the Constitution doesn't change. The Constitution is always the same. And then this decision says, well, we don't like where this would lead. So even though the Constitution doesn't say it, we're going to make this ruling, which, again, is just so inconsistent. Consistent to how they're supposed to make those decisions.
Well, and to go back to continue down that line, they're not abiding with their stated principles, but it's also not like this is where that part of the ruling to say that Congress has to enact this was totally unnecessary. They could have said that Colorado can't do this without the sort of and that's what the more liberal justices were complaining about in their dissent was that, or I guess a concurring, but a separate concurring statement, was that this was overreach, that the court that was not the question before the court, and the court taking up that question was, it really does sort of become legislating from the court. So it's not the original intent. It's not a restrained court. It's not states' rights. All the stuff that they claim to hold dear go out the window when it's inconvenient for them.
And maybe if this didn't come so closely to the immunity decision, it would be a little bit easier to understand. Mm-hmm. But when you've got two decisions back to back that are really either pro-Trump or afraid of Trump decisions, it's hard to see the Supreme Court being an institution that's standing up for itself, right? I mean, this is, we think about, when you have populist demagogues threatening the system, you would hope that the institutions of governance would push back. Initially you would hope that the political parties, that the Republicans would push back, and then the Senate had their chance to push back and they didn't, right? And so now it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court also said, we're going to pass on our opportunity to prevent somebody who's a danger to democracy to getting into a position of power. So, multiple different opportunities for the political system to prevent this danger from getting back into power. And at all these levels, and I think most egregiously at the Supreme Court, they passed on that opportunity.
Well, and I think what we're seeing, interesting, as you were talking, I'm thinking like the sort of heroic, like who stands up to the do the right thing, has been like, it's been largely absent at the national level, right? Where it's played out has been with state, you know, election employees, state, you know, attorneys general, like the people who are actually doing the brave stuff are the people who are further down the ladder, not the ones who are at the top, who should be the ones who are willing and able to do the right thing. I know that we need to move on at some point, but we haven't talked at all about, like, I feel like we're giving a little bit of a free pass to the liberal justices. Like real disappointment there in that. I think like, it felt like they also were afraid, or they felt the need to have a unified vote here, but I can't quite figure out them either in this situation where, I don't know. Are they sort of bullied into giving this? Are they afraid of Trump? Like, I don't, it makes less sense, from their perspective. I don't know. Is there any reason why I should be giving them more, more leeway in my criticism?
Well, I think maybe a little bit, right? I think the liberal justices don't couch themselves in originalism as much as the conservative justices do, right? So the conservatives are the ones that say the Constitution is always the same. You have to go back to the original intent. Whereas oftentimes the liberal justices say that it's an evolving Constitution, right? You take the principles and the ideals of the Constitution and you apply it to a modern world. And so maybe that perspective gets them to the point where they say this would be chaos. It would be anarchy. But I think they're open to some criticism to say you should have had this conversation about originalism, and, you know, you should call the conservative justices out on that and then make a more compelling case. Right. I agree with you. I think everybody is open to some criticism for just basically running away from making a hard decision. They didn't even grapple with the question of, did insurrection happen?
Right.
Right. I mean, again, this is an opportunity where the court could have said this was an egregious act. And it's not for the states to determine this. It's for Congress or judges or whatever it might be. But they skirt that question as well. Yeah. I mean, it was such an act of cowardice across the court. And I think the liberal justices deserve some criticism as well, too.
Yeah. So many other avenues, whether it's due process, whether it's to tackle the question of whether in this particular instance insurrection occurred. And so Colorado is justified. Yeah. So many other ways they could have dealt with this. And instead came up with they sort of neutered the 14th Amendment here. And that seems so contradictory to the supposed idea of they're there to uphold the Constitution. So, yeah,
it is. They look very much like a political institution at this point. And it's hard to come back from that. It's going to be hard to have Gorsuch or Alito lecture me about originalism on some issue that he believes in, right? So he's, you know, those are going to be difficult to read. And you know they're coming, Phil. They're coming.
100%. Yes.
So, all right, we'll come back to this for our third topic, but we are going to transition and talk a little bit about Super Tuesday. So yeah, we mentioned, Phil, yesterday was Super Tuesday, but if I'm honest, there was nothing all that super about it. I was genuinely more excited about the fact that it was Taco Tuesday. The results were not surprising in the least. Donald Trump rolled up victories across the country. And by the end of the evening, it was clear that the former president had left Nikki Haley in the delegate dust with coast-to-coast wins in California, North Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and beyond. Nikki Haley's sole victory was in Vermont, a development that after which she officially suspended her campaign this morning. Interestingly, she did not immediately endorse Donald Trump. Whether Haley will endorse Trump remains, for at least for me, one of the more lingering and important questions on the Republican side. Speaking of endorsements, after Haley exited the campaign this morning, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell offered an enthusiastic endorsement of Donald Trump for president. After years of acrimony between the two of them, officially cementing Trump's total continued hold on the Republican Party, McConnell said, quote, "It should come as no surprise that as a nominee, he will have my support." during his presidency. We worked together to accomplish great things for the American people, unquote. On the Democratic side, Joe Biden also racked up big victories. His only loss coming in a surprising yet politically inconsequential upset in the American Samoa Democratic caucuses, where entrepreneur Jason Palmer, talk about this guy suddenly getting in the news, he bested him. Phil, while this was not the most dramatic Super Tuesday, there are a lot of important developments to break down. Nikki Haley suspending her campaign, Mitch McConnell bending the knee, and maybe most importantly, we now officially know that the 2024 election will be a carbon copy of the 2020 election. So what do you take away from last night's developments?
I think the first big takeaway is that we're finally here. We're at the place that it seemed like we were heading for a long time, yes. Which is that we've got a Biden versus Trump, unless something really dramatic happens, unless one of them, you know, dies or resigns or is sent to prison or whatever. Yeah, right. we're facing a Biden versus Trump election in 2024. And that is something that it feels like the vast majority of Americans don't want. And it feels that immediately takes me back to how well is our system working if this is what it is. And, yeah, you know, you and I have talked about, like, you and I don't have the sort of issues with Biden's age or whatever that a lot of other people do. I'm not all that worried about it. But the fact that it's not particularly reflective, you know, I think about, you know, when I teach about democracy and comparative politics, one of the standards that comes up that, like, Robert Dahl and some of the other bigwigs in political science have talked about is, in order for a system of democracy to, like, truly be democratic, there has to be some like reflection of the people's will in the outcomes. And this is not policy. This is, you know, personnel, but it still, like, makes me, you know, pause and think a little bit about that. So, I mean, I think coming to terms with that, but I do find the other part that I think is interesting is, you know, as you look at, like, I don't know, 6 months ago, if you had asked me to decide whether Nikki Haley or Mitch McConnell was going to endorse Donald Trump, I would have thought Nikki Haley, yes, Mitch McConnell, right, no, right. Right? And so to see in such a short period of time, I don't know, to see and Nikki Haley may very well still endorse him, but so much of her campaign, right, yeah, towards the end was about, I think, trying to lay out a path for not only why she's different, but to try to make an argument that Donald Trump doesn't fully control the party, right? That there, yeah, is some remnant of the Republican Party left that has not fallen under the spell of Donald Trump. And so for her to turn around and endorse him is a pretty big turnaround. I don't, you know, I think she might still do it, but yeah, it's kind of interesting to see that progression. And again, Mitch McConnell, who, like, in public sort of put on a good front to some extent, but was, you know, by all indications, all reports, was, you know, done with, sick of Donald, yeah, Trump. He, like, to see him in this moment endorsing Donald Trump, especially now that he's no longer leader and it doesn't, like, it matters less whether he's on board with Donald Trump. It makes me think of what we talked about when we talked about was it disloyal Democrats? This idea of, like,
semi-loyal Democrats. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Semi-loyal, yep, Democrats. This idea of, like, this is the exact moment that Mitch McConnell now is freer than ever to actually speak his mind. And instead he knows how dangerous Donald Trump is and is still willing to essentially put party above principle here. And that's, it's not like I had high hopes for Mitch McConnell, but for an action of Mitch McConnell to actually even, you know, surprise me in the extent to which it's disappointing is telling, yeah, I think.
No, I think that's such an important point, right? Because I love this concept. I was thinking about the semi-loyal Democrats, small D Democrats from Levitsky and Zablatt, right? I mean, they argue that this category of individuals, you know, the members of the party who are facing off against a populist demagogue and realize the danger that individual poses, but nonetheless continue to support them out of political expediency because it's in their own political future. And so Mitch McConnell, who's taken stands against Donald Trump on issues like Ukraine and elsewhere, where he's managed to stand up. Today, when I heard the endorsement, I was thinking back to his comments after the insurrection, where he blames Donald Trump. He comes out and says it's Donald Trump. For somebody like that, who clearly knows better, has not spoken to Trump in a couple of years, to still endorse Donald Trump speaks to the control that Donald Trump has over the party. And even though Mitch McConnell is going away, he's afraid that his legacy as a Republican will be tarnished if he does this one act. And it's so revealing, because he's got nothing else to lose except for his reputation. And even that is still, you know, it's still not worth it to go out and speak out against Donald Trump. That's maybe the most stunning news of the day, I think, bigger than anything that happened on Super Tuesday. And that development makes me think that it's only a matter of weeks before Nikki Haley will also do the same thing. There's no pathway for a Republican who wants to remain relevant to not endorse Donald Trump, unless you want to be Mitt Romney or you want to be Liz Cheney. The only pathway is to endorse and bend the knee. And so that makes me think I will be surprised and delighted if Nikki Haley says, I can't do this. But I all evidence suggests that every Republican has to fall in line. And so I think that's coming as well. But I hope I'm wrong.
But, you know, as we've talked about for 6 years now, or 5 years, you know, longer, I guess the last few years have been a blur, whatever, 9 years that we've been talking about Donald Trump in the Republican Party. It's a collective action problem, though. Like, you're right. Yeah. There's no path forward unless you want to be Mitt Romney. But that's because nobody's willing to actually speak up and say this. And I don't know. Even that quote from McConnell, right, where he says it should come as no surprise that as nominee, he will have my support. That reveals, I mean, that is partly why Donald Trump has been able to so effectively sort of, take over, prey on the Republican Party, is that there, I think, is this old notion in a pre-Trump notion about party loyalty, and like, you fall in line behind your nominee. That's what matters. And back in the old days, that made sense, right? Like, you had a bunch of people who battled it out for each other. And even though they had disagreements, it was, you know, it was expected that when their party settled on someone, you fell in line behind them. And it's like they are like unable to recognize that Donald Trump is a different beast, right? Like, that this is not the same thing as, you know, Bob Dole conceding because George Bush has won the nomination or whatever. And so, it just feels like Donald Trump's sort of, again, willingness to burn things to the ground, and Republicans' like insistence or willingness or belief that falling in line is important, is this like toxic mix here that plays out. It's really puzzling to see.
It is, right? And so we got to think about what comes next, right? So if everybody continues to come and support Donald Trump on this, it sounds like the next step is the chair of the RNC is going to be, is it Laura Trump? I can't remember which one of the family members is going to take over the RNC. So what he's doing, right, he's turning the political party into the Trump party. And that's so astonishing to think that is where the party is at right now. But nobody has the ability to push back. And, you know, you think back to after the 2022 midterms, there was a real chance that the party was going to move on from Donald Trump. They had just gotten, you know, the returns for the midterms were devastating for Republicans. There was real conversation about it's time to move past him. But yet, nevertheless, in 2024, we find ourselves back in this place where he is in utter and complete control of the party. It is his political party. I'm sure they won't have another platform this year, because the party will not stand for anything other than what Donald Trump believes the party stands for. It's a terrible place for a political party to be in, because there's no place to move, right? It's all dependent upon the future of Donald Trump.
It really is a cult of, your point about a platform, it becomes a cult of personality. You can't have a party platform, because it depends on whatever Donald Trump thinks, and that changes from day to day. So you can't lay out sort of any principle. The principle is support for Donald Trump, right? And sort of, I think the sort of animosity towards liberals or anyone on the outside who doesn't like Donald Trump.
It's really something, right? And so even though Super Tuesday itself wasn't real exciting, that development was there. Also interesting, Joe Biden had a really good day. He's winning all the states he's supposed to winning. His margins are good. But the way that is reported is really fascinating, right? There's been a lot of attention on Joe Biden underperforming. Whereas if you sort of broke down the opinion polls, I think Trump underperformed to some yeah. degree in a number of states where his win was not as big as it should be. It's interesting to see sort of that narrative back and forth. But I think Biden's putting himself in good position. I think at the end of the day, this is really going to be about Donald Trump and not so much about yes. Joe Biden. Or if the campaign is smart, they will shift it away from Joe Biden's yeah. age and make it about Donald Trump. Yes. I mean, that's where they really have to be.
I think you're totally right. Well, that's actually probably a really good transition to our next topic.
Yeah.
Do you want to? All right. So
let's do it.
So building off of this conversation, both of the conversations about courts and about Super Tuesday, let's talk a little bit about the coming election and about Trump's re-election. So this week, Jennifer Medina and Reed Epstein made a compelling argument in the New York Times that Americans are suffering a collective amnesia about Trump and his 4 years in office. When Trump left office, his approval rating was at 34%. And today, when asked about his time in office, it's up to 46%. So 12% of Americans have come around in the last 4 years to reconsidering and deciding that Donald Trump, maybe his first term was good. So Republicans are now more likely than to see the January 6th rioters as protesters and not, insurrectionists, and to believe that Trump actually won the election. But those, we focus on those, but those misrememberings are just the tip of the iceberg. The Trump term was so chaotic that much of the insanity got lost in the storm. So the article from Medina and Epstein lists just a few things that people might have forgotten. And I thought it was worth just reading these because it was even a nice reminder for me. So
yeah.
this is just a partial list. The recording of Mr. Trump saying he could grab women by the genitals, praising Russian intelligence, crudely disparaging African countries, separating children from their parents at the Mexican border, telling children Santa Claus isn't real, considering buying Greenland, suggesting using nuclear weapons to stop a hurricane, threatening to withhold from aid from Ukraine if its president wouldn't investigate the Biden family, suggesting that COVID patients inject bleach. So, it's just there's the very long list of things we could just keep going, right? I think back to when we were doing a podcast during the Trump years, figuring out just what to talk about every week was insane because so much happened. So Thomas Edsel made a similar point in the Times, arguing that the now delayed Trump trials were likely to play an important role in reminding people of the nature of Trump. And that if we can't seem to prosecute Trump for his behavior, then who would be subject to prosecution? if we can't bring a case against Trump, then who? There's a variety of reasons why this might be happening. People are more focused on Biden than Trump. That's not unusual in a lead up to an election. People, especially Trump supporters, are more likely to remember the positives than the negatives. So they're more likely to look back and think about a strong stock market as opposed to a sort of devastating COVID lockdown. And certainly our deep partisanship contributes to our cognitive filters where we find ways to see what we want to see. But Bill, it is really unbelievable to watch a country that lived through the Trump years come around to a different understanding of those years in such a short time frame. It's not unusual, in over the period of decades, right? 30, 40 years later, look back and see a presidency different. But this is happening so quickly. And as we approach an election, the importance of this is clear. So what do you make of our national collective amnesia here? What's your take on this?
It's hard not to have a pretty negative view of the American public when you kind of think about how quickly this occurs. I was trying to think of historical patterns or historical comparison, and the only one that I could really think of is Ronald Reagan. Everybody loves Reagan now, and at least over the last couple decades, his popularity has grown quite dramatically. When you go back and look at, kind of read about the history of the Reagan presidency, it wasn't very good, especially, you and I teach foreign policy. When you read about Reagan's foreign policy, other than kind of the end of the Cold War, it was a disaster, right? Iran-Contra, all of these things domestically was not particularly strong, but people remember Reagan better. They remember him as a great president, even though the presidency wasn't that great. But that took a long time. Yeah. There was some distance between now and then. But Trump, like, we could say it just happened, right? This is a couple of years ago. But it's such a great explanation for what we're witnessing. You know, in general, publics don't like their incumbents. And you can look around the world right now and you look at some of the polling of leaders in power, and their polling is terrible. Biden is actually better than most of these other European powers, if we think about it. But so I think some of that is the economy. There's a general frustration. Incumbency is a big burden now. But the fact that even though it's been a difficult economic time, that you completely forget about what happened to that. When you were reading through that list, and again, that's just a fraction of it, it's stunning. One of those things should have ended, you know, any sort of political candidacy. I struggle to not condemn the American public for being such nincompoops on this stuff. And the other thing, and then I'll let you respond, is it's what makes the Supreme Court delay of the immunity case so important. Yeah. And I think Edsel talks about this, that he interviews one of these constitutional scholars, and they were making the argument that the immunity case is the most important case possibly in the nation's history, right? Holding a president accountable for attempting to overturn an election is a big, big deal. And it would remind the American public of what happened, what Donald Trump did. And that's really important thing to do before you have an election to decide whether you want to bring that person in power. So the Supreme Court intervening to slow roll all of this is, again, a very, very political and not a particularly good thing for democracy. So I don't know, Phil, you and I forget things all the time. Is this maybe it's not such a big deal? I don't know.
No, it's a big deal. And it's baffling, right? I mean, because we do tend to we hold on to these sort of political grudges and whatnot in America in a way that it's weird to see people. And Trump is such a like divisive figure that like it's hard to think. It's just hard to understand how people could like experience his presidency in a negative way and then somehow in 3 years forget it. And I think, you know, it has to do with the deep partisanship that we have right now. It has to do with the information environment that we live in. The people that I know, family or otherwise, who listen to Fox News have been hearing, you know, a different version of the Trump presidency for 3 years. And because they're not being constantly confronted with new like insanities, it's easy to tell that story and to convince yourself that, well, maybe, you know, memory is problematic anyway. And so without the sort of constant presence of Trump to remind you that he is insane, it's easy to, I don't know, convince yourself that maybe it wasn't so bad. I also think this is, I mean, ultimately it is the fact, I think this has to do with the fact that so much attention is on Biden, right? And I think a big part of it is, this is about the divides within the party. I mean, I think Biden is in a tough place right now, not just because of the economy, but I think, you know, young people, my students, don't particularly like him. Right. And that's because of some of his policies. It's his approach to Israel. It's like, there's just a lot of stuff going on right now. And so, again, if you're focused on Joe Biden, and I don't really like Joe Biden, you can somehow come around to, well, maybe Donald Trump is better. But it is just that would make sense to me if it were like if you told me. I think Joe Biden has had a remarkable, like, I think a generally a really successful term. And if he were running against Mitt Romney, right, or Liz Cheney, and there were young people who were convinced that, well, maybe I'll vote for Joe Biden hasn't been, I don't love his Israel policy, so maybe I'll get behind Liz Cheney. Even if that's like misguided, it's understandable. But Donald Trump, there's right. like so much evidence, like so yes. much of who he is so clear. And I think you're exactly right. I think the times where attention has been brought back to who Donald Trump is, it hasn't been good for him, whether that's the January 6th hearings, which I know didn't like, you know, bring like it wasn't a death blow for him, but there was a temporary shift in how people viewed Donald Trump, right? And that was just an occasionally televised congressional hearing. Right. If Donald Trump had been on trial, it would have been the news story every night. And someday it will be, right? And at some point this will happen, I think. Unless he dies before he can be brought to justice in some way. But yeah, it would be, you know, everyone would be reminded in stark, clear ways of the things that they have forgotten. Yeah. But yeah, it is amazing. I'm sure there are things that I've forgotten that Trump did as well, but the overall sense of what it was like in a Trump presidency is not forgotten at all for me.
I'm sure you see this in your classroom as well. So, you know, we were dealing with 18, 19, 20 year olds, some of whom were young during the don't remember the Trump presidency. And when you show them, so like in my foreign policy class, we do a day on North Korea and we look at the Trump presidency and all of Trump's tweets about North Korea, the fact that at the UN, he said he was going to totally destroy North Korea, that he had, you know, had a bigger button on his desk. And they see this and they're sort of blown away. And then Trump says, well, I fell in love with Kim Jong-un. They're watching this going, this can't have really happened. Yep. Right. So there's also this new crop of voters who need to be reminded of all that. The other interesting thing about the Ed Saul piece, which was so great, is you and I talk about this all the time. Our listeners probably are following politics daily and are on top of all of this, but not all of the American public is. And they talked about that the percentage of the public that didn't know. They were asking a question about how much do you know about the charges against Trump? And this data, 20 to 25% of those surveyed said they did not know. And 25%, they were not sure what charges were being brought against Trump. That really says, so roughly 50% of the American public isn't aware of the charges that are pending against Donald Trump. To me, that seems astonishing because we spend so much time talking about the various cases, but there's a huge chunk of the American public that knows something's going on, but doesn't know what it's all about, right? And that's why these trials, and I think the big meta picture, if you're Joe Biden, you've got to focus a spotlight back on Donald Trump and remind the American public what happened. This can't just be about turnout. It's really got to be about who this individual is and telling that story.
Yeah. And there's an argument there that this election, you know, I think the conventional wisdom has become that it's all about turnout and that there aren't swing voters. But I kind of wonder in this particular election if there are, because there are some who have changed their mind about Donald Trump, right? And I think those become a different type of swing voter, right? It's not like a party swing. It is needing to remind those voters what's on the line. And I think that's where this becomes, that's kind of where this election goes. And it comes back around to a couple of things about this election, which is, I think this is a slam dunk for Republicans if they nominate anyone other than Donald Trump. Like, I think Nikki Haley as nominee, you know, would have won this, would be able to beat Joe Biden because Joe Biden's weaknesses are enough that people would be willing to put their, you know, whatever, their trust in Nikki Haley. But what's, I still remain, despite this collective amnesia that we have, you're exactly right, which is that most Americans get up and do their job and they come home and they're making food and cleaning houses and dealing with children and doing all this other stuff. Yep. And they're not thinking about this stuff. There's all sorts of research that says most Americans won't think about this until much, much closer to the election to the actual election. And so I think for them to have forgotten maybe it's like inconceivable to me as a political scientist, but it's also understandable in some way because they're dealing with their own lives. And that's all about to change. That's the part where I have been, conssistently sort of optimistic about this election. I don't want to be too optimistic, but I remain there because I think what's about to happen is when this is set, now that it's essentially settled, and as we get closer, the focus is going to again be on Donald Trump, and Joe Biden's going to be able to point to all that stuff. And the other thing that one of these articles brought up is that Donald Trump is hurting for money now after losing all of these cases, and Joe Biden is like flush with cash, and so you're about to see massive ad campaigns. You're going to see all sorts of stuff that will remind Americans of all of this stuff. In a 30-second clip, you can put a whole bunch of insanity of Donald Trump in there and remind people of the chaos that was his administration. And I think that's, again, this is, if you're Joe Biden, I can see why you love this rematch, right? Like it isn't about Joe Biden. It's about like you don't want him again.
That's absolutely right. And one of the articles, I can't remember if it was the Ed Saul or one, but they talked about that there still is an anti-MAGA majority in the country. And it is about reawakening that group. And as you said, making them, reminding them, or for the new batch of voters, you know, making them aware of what the Donald Trump presidency was like, what that, what the threat to democracy is. And that if they're not rattled, right, what really motivates the anti-MAGA majority is fear. Mm-hmm. And so this isn't an election about Joe Biden. It's not about telling him why Joe's so great and how he got the Green New Deal through and all these other things. It's really about mobilizing them through fear and of what a Donald Trump presidency could represent. And that if they do that effectively, they'll show up at the polls. But if it's not done effectively, they'll stay away. Yeah. And that creates a space where Donald Trump could win again. So it really is. It's, again, I think it connects back to the Supreme Court and the importance of having these trials prior to the election. And it sounds like the document case is, there's no chance that's going to happen before the election. One hopes that the immunity case can at least be heard so that the American public can be aware of this. And I think that's only fair to have a real reckoning with what happened on January 6th and the former president's role. And, you know, and if it comes out that it's clean, you know, that he deserves that right as well. I don't think it will be, but I think that's why the Supreme Court intervention was so unnecessary and aggressive in terms of intervening in the political process when they tend to say that they're supposed to stay removed from it all.
Is that, I mean, we need to move on, but that's, you know, thinking about the logic of their intervention, is there's some hesitancy of the court, this is a total shift in gears, to sort of put their finger on the scales during an election season. And it feels like that's what they were doing with Colorado. I kind of wonder if that was part of the logic of taking up this case, was to like, hey, this is an issue to be settled, but it's an issue that should probably come after an election rather than in the middle of the election, when in fact, it's an issue that's massively important for the election. So anyway,
I keep trying to find reasons for why they took the case that aren't political in nature. And remember, it's not the whole court. It only took four justices to bring this case, but it sure does feel like, once again, putting their finger on the thumb. And I don't want a Supreme Court. I don't want to be thinking that, but they're just giving me so much evidence, Phil. I don't know how you get around it. So, all right, for our final topic, we're going to switch gears a bit and look at some fascinating cutting edge research in political science. And it's a book out by Jeffrey Friedman, who is a professor of government at Dartmouth College. The book is titled The Commander in Chief Test. Friedman undertakes case studies on election years in which foreign policy was particularly important. So those elections where there was lots of discussion about foreign policy. He finds that, contrary to conventional wisdom, voters want a candidate who they perceive as a competent commander in chief more than they want a candidate whose policies, positions they agree with, which I think is fascinating. In other words, the American public wants leaders who appear to be strong, independent, and a decisive leader, even if that is in contrast to their preferred foreign policy interest. The effect of this, as the argument, is that it encourages candidates and sitting presidents to take hawkish positions and reject international compromise, which ironically conflicts with voters' actual policy preferences. Friedman refers to this as the issue-image trade-off. He defines the issue-image trade-off as a policy position that is not popular on its merits, but that the public officials nonetheless use to craft a favorable impression of their own personal qualities. In the book, he demonstrates that this behavior is common in presidential politics and that it consistently steers U.S. foreign policy in a direction that is more hawkish than what voters want. Now, as an example, he points to Lyndon Johnson's, for instance, who asked Congress to provide an open-ended authorization for the use of force in Vietnam as a way to rebut charges that he was soft on communism, even though voters did not support escalating the war. Or Bill Clinton's presidential campaign manager, who advised him to bomb Serbia to look strong, even though a minority of voters supported military intervention in the Balkans. He also points to Donald Trump, who regularly criticizes allies to show that he was a hard-nosed bargainer who would prevent other countries from taking advantage of the United States, even though most voters dislike Trump's abrasive posturing on its own. Friedman notes that this could prove particularly dangerous with respect to U.S.-China relations, where presidents and presidential candidates have incentives to use their China policies as proving grounds for demonstrating their vigilance, and they will not back down in the face of aggression. Phil, this is really, really interesting and suggests that voter views on policy don't really matter all that much. So what's your reaction to all this?
So this is fascinating. I mean, this is a really interesting argument. I think there's a couple of levels to go at this. I mean, the first is from this very specific, you know, foreign policy image perspective, which is, I think there's just a lot of truth to this. When I think back to whether it's JFK and this need to look yes, you know, strong on communism, and the how that sort of feeds into his support for the Bay of Pigs invasion and a lot of the other stuff. Certainly LBJ, we know all sorts of evidence that LBJ was, essentially the idea of losing in Vietnam was unacceptable, even during a time when public support of the Vietnam yes. War was falling dramatically, right? Joe Biden in Afghanistan, right? Like we talk about like how it, and this is to some extent evidence of why presidents behave this way. Like there was so much like sort of wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth with the way that was handled, even though we had for a decade and a half had the American people like wanting us to get out of, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and whatever. So there's this weird, like the things that we want and what it takes to get them are incompatible for voters. So we want a strong leader, even though the image of what we think a strong leader looks like isn't in line with what the policies are that we want. And I think that is, it plays perfectly into Donald Trump's hands, right? Like, so it can be crazy. His foreign policy towards North Korea and NATO and everyone else can be crazy, but he seems, you know, strong and decisive. And so that for whatever reason, even though it's insane and might bring us to nuclear war, we like right. the tough guy act. I think, you know, anybody, like, I think there's probably, you know, I was gonna say dozens, hundreds, thousands of, women scholars out there who are saying like, well, duh, right? Like this is the argument right. that has been made for a long time about like, you know, Hillary Clinton's views were much more in line sort of with like mainstream views of foreign policy than Donald Trump. But the idea of what it means to be a strong, independent and decisive leader means that someone who's sort of nuanced and thoughtful about things looks indecisive or weak. Right. And it's something that we have to get over as Americans. Yes. But this idea of like perverse incentives, I think is something that's really important for people to understand that like it is, if you want a quote unquote strong leader, you are incentivizing presidents to act in certain ways, even when they are kind of opposed to what you might actually want in foreign policy. We have all sorts of, you know, weird incentives set up in the American system as well that create, you know, a need for an image or a need for a certain voting bloc creates a policy that is incompatible or in contrast with what the general public wants. What's your take on it?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up the issue of women as well, because I was explaining this to my colleague, Dr. Suzanne Chad, who we've had on the podcast. And because I think this argument is really, really fascinating. And she's like, well, they talk about toxic masculinity, right? I was like, well, not directly, but it's certainly there, right? It is absolutely there as part of this dynamic of aggression. And it becomes basically a security dilemma where each side is trying to out tough the other side. And it's frustrating because it means that voters' interests aren't really considered. And you're right. There's so many examples of this. But Donald Trump is just the most recent one where, you know, his positions are not popular. Like people like NATO, but he spends all this time criticizing NATO and NATO allies. Yeah. The border, you know, Trump's actual border policies, I'm guessing most people don't agree with. You know, you mentioned, you know, putting children in cages, right? People didn't like that, but he's tough on the border. So that image overwhelms the actual issue itself. And people say, well, he's tough, he's strong. And you're seeing this, to go back to our previous topic, you're seeing some of this in those voters who supported Biden in 2020, who now are leaning towards supporting Donald Trump, say that, well, Trump is strong. He's going to defend the country. It's not a nuanced discussion of foreign policy issues. It's just that he's strong. He creates an image of strength. Now, that can be very, very dangerous, but it certainly is appealing to voters. And yeah, so it's a really wonderful, if not dangerous, explanation of U.S. foreign policy.
The thing I think about is our conversation, again, the episode's sort of blurred. I don't remember if it was last week or week before when we were talking about Trump's proposed trade war, which was going to be even more extensive than the last time around. And it's a perfect example of where it is harmful to Americans. And in terms of policy preferences, like to some extent, I think that's an example of where policy and image kind of go hand in hand, where even though people shouldn't support that policy, the idea of it looks strong to be like to stick it to China, even if sticking it to China really means sticking it to me, right? Like I'm willing to hurt myself in order to look strong. I think the technical term is that that's messed up.
That's right. And especially the US-China one is such a great example, because what we're likely to see moving forward over the next decade is more and more of this, where we're going to see candidates trying to out-tough each other. So, I mean, Joe Biden, who has long experience in foreign policy, has fallen prey to this, right? So the spy balloon incident where Joe Biden is like randomly shooting down any sort of balloon in the air because he's so worried about not looking tough on China. He wants to create that image, not explain to the American public that actually this isn't that grave of a threat, because image matters more than policy preferences. And it's sort of frustrating. We keep coming back to the American public not being particularly savvy on a whole host of issues, but
our listeners get it. They're smart.
That's right, because they're paying attention, right? You know, there's an elite that pays attention and grapples with these issues. But you said there's a whole bunch of the rest of the American public that doesn't have time or interest or whatever that might be. But it means that their politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, are pursuing positions, foreign policy positions, that are way more hawkish than they actually want. That to me, that is a striking consequence.
Yes, I think this is, I mean, in a couple of different ways, this idea explains sort of the rise of Donald Trump, right? I think just in general within the party, where image sort of matters more than substance, right? So having someone who looks strong is more important than whether their policies actually benefit me. This is kind of the what's the matter with Kansas sort of argument or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's all domestic policy. But yes, I think it's really important to realize the ways in which, we talk about in foreign policy, like we talk about the ways in which, misperceptions, miscommunications, like even sort of rational behavior can lead to disaster. And this is a perfect, we're not talking about, tax policy, right? We're talking about the potential for war with China, right? And we have incentivized people to do things that are not the rational or the reasonable thing, because looking strong is important to the American voters. Yeah, we all collectively as a country really need to go see a therapist.
That's right. It also reveals how much, we talk about this a lot. Political science and political science scholars, we know a lot about how the world works and what's going on there. And I think our country could benefit from more engagement with these ideas, because it's really interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Well, we should probably wrap up. You want to remind everybody they're going to be so interested in going to the webpage and doing some reading.
Yeah. So thepoliticslab.com, you can go there, click on this week's episode, and my mind went blank. Why can't I think of his name? The George Conway article. There you go. About the Supreme Court decision is there. The collective amnesia article that we talked about is there. The Edsel article. And then also this last one that we talked about, the Friedman article about image versus substance. Is all four of those are there for easy access if you want to read a little bit more about some of the stuff we talked about, all at thepoliticslab.com.
That's great. All right, Phil, I will see you next week in Florida.
Yes. Can't wait, Phil.
Bye, Phil.